and preaching, so it is useless for me to go to that school. Instead, Scarry said, Papa, I wish you let me read law with Judge Foster. I wish you to ask him, I can do this. Jeannot, to doctor, this was unwelcome request, as he once treat Judge Foster's daughter, Laura Rose, for consumption, and she die. He explained to the judge that disease was far gone, nothing save her, but the judge turned his grieve into hate for doctor. So he could not ask that. And Scarry left home. He said he would go to Canada and find his tribe. He was very angry and he left. P.S. Forgive, I forget writing like Beatrix showed us.
52. Kauri. Jeannot felt as a fallen pine must feel, hurled into another world. London was not the larger Boston he had expected, but a sweating, boiling turmoil of thieves, cloudy-eyed horses with bad legs, miry streets, each with its equine corpse, the stink of excrement and coal smoke and burned cabbage, and extraordinary glimpses of silk and exotic feather, where crossing sweepers with brooms cleared a way for pedestrians. Mr. Bone had leased quarters for a month in a shabby-genteel neighborhood a mile from the great wharves and bustle of shipping. The axemaker's rooms were pleasant, with a sitting room and a bedroom featuring a carved mahogany bedstead enclosed by only slightly moldy bed curtains. Jeannot's adjoining room was small and dark, but Mr. Bone graciously invited him to share the sitting room.
"Come, Mr. Jeannot Sell," said Mr. Bone on the first morning ashore. "Let us walk about in this greatest city in the world. I will show you the wonders of the place. Let us go down to the wharves."
They left the avenue of decaying Georgian residences for a street of ironmongers, red piles of metal, and dumps of coal. Jeannot flinched at the sight of a family of ragged adults and their swarm of filthy, emaciated children.
"Likely refugees forced off rural lands by enclosure," Mr. Bone remarked.
Hundreds of workers rushed about, navvies and dock workers, cobble settlers laying stones, scavengers, sooty sweeps emptying their buckets into the river. They heard cheers and shouts nearby.
"What is that hullabaloo?" said Mr. Bone. "Let us see."
Rounding the corner, they came on a pair of fighting men circled by 40 or more shouting onlookers. Jeannot remarked that the English seemed to enjoy fisticuffs as much as drunken barkskins.
"We are a fighting race," said Mr. Bone with relish as they walked on.
Newspaper hawkers thrust their wares in the men's faces, and among a dozen bills pasted on the side of a warehouse, one shouted in swollen letters, "Emigration to New Zealand."
"Ah, Mr. Edward Wakefield, the gentleman behind the New Zealand Company, is an immensely clever Englishman," said Mr. Bone. "He has very sound ideas on colonization. He has a sense of feeling for the solid English working man and small businessman as well as the gentry. He understands that random settlement, as happened in the American colonies, is contrary to clear reason and scientific method. His plan of systematic colonization is admirable, for then society is stratified from the beginning with correct classes. Had England done this with the American colonies and Canada, those countries would not be ruled by the pig-headed creatures of today."
He looked at his watch and said,
"Enough sightseeing. Let us hurry. I have a meeting."
Mr. Bone's chief advisor was a missionary of obscure Protestant denomination, the Reverend Mr. Edward Torrance Rainborough, possessed of a thick jaw, blue with crowding whiskers, a mouth as wide as his face, and inside it a set of pale green teeth. His basso completed the picture of an overbearing bully, but he had tamed his voice to a quiet pitch, and he smiled. There were a dozen travelers at the meeting. A tall-headed fellow speculated how long the voyage from London to New Zealand might take.
"Depending on weather and the favor of God, it might be as swift as 5 months, or considerably more," said a jowly missionary who repeatedly filled his wine glass. "First port of call will be Port Jackson, the convict colony, which will also be the departure point for New Zealand. The convict transports go on to that island and pick up a load of masts before returning to England. The trees are of high quality."
One of Mr. Bone's correspondents had sent him a letter saying the Maori inhabitants, embroiled in constant wars with one another, were the most ferocious savages on the planet, bloodthirsty cannibals. Their faces were scarified in hideous whorls and dots. As for clothing, they dressed in vegetable matter. Another missionary, there were seven in the group, Mr. Boxall, with a young girlish face, spoke directly to Mr. Bone.
"I have heard differently, that the Maori are an intelligent and even spiritual people held under the sway of the Prince of Darkness. They are hungry for messages of peace."
Mr. Rainborough resented this incursion into his own friendship with Mr. Bone, and after their dinner of pork cheek and withered potatoes prepared by one of the missionary wives, he put his lips close to the factory man's ear.
"Dear Mr. Bone, I will let you know about passage from Australia to New Zealand, accommodation I am trying to secure, even as we speak."
From the other side of the table, Gineau begged his attention.
"Sir, Mr. Bone, I wish to return to Boston. I have no desire to meet those wild people."
But Mr. Bone was enthusiastic about visiting the cannibals.
"Thank you, Reverend Rainborough," he said, then turned to Gineau and said in a low, severe voice, "I sincerely doubt that they are truly eaters of human flesh. It is one of those sailors' tales, and you, of all people, are being unjust. I can well believe they are only protecting their land from men who would seize it unfairly. With kind treatment, in time, they will come to see how pleasant their lives would become with some of the white man's inventions."
Frugal missionaries often took passage on convict transport, and though Gineau objected, he found himself swept aboard the Double Hail with Mr. Bone. Seasickness doubled most of the passengers, but not Mr. Rainborough, who continued to enjoy his morning bacon. Gineau had never seen such a busy man, for the missionary rushed about from first light to lanterns out. Mr. Boxall, his friend again, followed in his wake with his little yellow notebook. Below decks, the dangerous felons crouched in chains and cramped cubbies, the convicts England was pleased to remove from her finer population. Gineau was wearied by pitching decks, the missionary's zeal, the ocean's monotonous view of a horizon as flat as a sawed plank. Everywhere the spread of ocean showed it was not the Atlantic, which had given Gineau the odor of life forever. Even deep in the main lumber camps, certain weatherly days would bring the salt taste of it to him, 100 miles distant. Stern, cold, inimical, resentful of men, rock-girt, and often flashing with cruel storms, for him, for all Mi'kmaq, it was the only true ocean. And like a salmon, he longed to go back to it. When Australia finally came in sight as a great recumbent sausage at the edge of the world, he wondered how he could bear to sail still farther on to New Zealand. Only the thought of the interminable return voyage to Boston and a lack of passage money, for Mr. Bone had paid him no wages since they left Boston, kept him silent. He was fated to continue with the axemaker. Port Jackson smelled different and unfamiliar, a somewhat dry, roasty odor like parched coffee and burning twigs. Through the strange trees flew birds of shocking colors, iridescent and violently noisy, birds with headdresses and wings like burning angels, flying apparitions from dreams. But in the month the travelers lingered in the colony awaiting passage, whenever they walked out, they saw creatures that surpassed any nightmare, springing, fur-covered beasts with rudder-like tails, lizards swelling out their throats in gruesome puffs, assorted spiders said to be fatally poisonous. In Port Jackson, the missionary arranged with a Maori who had come to sell New Zealand flax that he should give lessons in his language to himself and Mr. Bone. Soon Mr. Bone was flinging such words as tapu, waka, wahini, itu, ihu about, and imagining himself a fluent speaker of this Polynesian language. Gineau was disheartened to see that the same detestable double hail that had carried them from England would now take them to New Zealand. There were several Maoris on board, and Mr. Bone spoke to them in what he imagined was their language. the energetic Mr. Rainborough had better luck and began proselytizing whenever he caught one of the Maoris gazing out to sea. Jeannot was surprised to see that they listened with interest and asked questions. As for Jeannot, the natives immediately classed him as an inferior servant to Mr. Bone and ignored him. They sailed up a river past gullied stumpland, and the voyage ended in a busy settlement. The dominant building was near the wharf, a trader's huge whare hoka. Next to this warehouse stood a chandler's shop, ornamented with an old anchor for a sign. Two shacks leaned off to one side. The larger bore a sign that said New Zealand Company. The houses of the Pākehā traders and government men ranged along streets terracing the hillside. Behind a screen of distant trees was the Maori village, Pa, fenced round with poles. Farther back loomed a fantastic tangle of ferns, trees, creepers, and exotic fragrances. A fresh world.
A translator will soon join you, Mr. Bone. You must excuse me, as I am going to see the site chosen for our mission,
said Mr. Rainborough. Mr. Bone and Jeannot waited for the translator, a Scotsman, John Grapple, whom they could see descending the steep path. Grapple walked gingerly, and Jeannot guessed he was wary of falling on the precipitous way. He reached them at the same time a Maori canoe drew up on the beach, and a muscular native man jumped out and walked toward them. They came together under a mott of trees.
"Well then," said Grapple, showing his crimson face and fiery nose, "this chief speaks no English, so I will translate for you."
The moment Mr. Bone heard John Grapple's Scots burr, he loved him, and the two talked for a quarter hour, working out a remote kinship, before they turned to the Maori who stood waiting, his heavy arms folded across his chest. Mr. Bone showed off some of his Maori words, and amazingly, this man, his brown face a map of curled and dotted tattoos, and clad in a sinuous flaxen cloak that tickled his ankles, understood some of the compromised phrases. At first, the two men seemed pleased with each other. The chief wondered if Mr. Bone had come to buy flax. No? Sealskins? No? Spars? No? What then? Mr. Bone, casting his limited vocabulary aside, looked at John Grapple to translate as he tried to describe axe-making and his plan for a factory. With a stick, he drew figures on the ground that represented an axe on a forge and a looming trip-hammer. To further illustrate, Mr. Bone removed a Penobscot model axe he carried in his valise and handed it to the chief. The chief's eyes widened with pleasure as he examined the quality and beauty of the axe. Too late, Mr. Bone realized that the man believed it was a gift rather than a demonstration of goods.
"Well, no matter. I have others," he muttered to himself.
"You got others?"
asked the chief in fluent, if rather sudden, English.
"Let me congratulate you on your rapid command of our language. As to the axes, yes, I have others, but they are only to show. I hope to manufacture them here as soon as we establish a source of good iron ore in New Zealand. I am the owner of an axe factory in the United States. I hope to construct one here."
A crowd had gathered around them, stretching their necks to see the axe. "What is wrong with these people?" said Mr. Bone to John Grapple sotto voce. "One would think they had never seen an axe before."
"I think that may be the case," said Grapple.
The chief smiled delightedly.
"Oh, my friend," he said to Mr. Bone, "that is good. Good, good. Come with me. We wish to make a pilfery and huckery feast for you and your fickery," he said, glancing at Jeannot. "I think, sir," whispered Jeannot, "that he believes I am the factory. He sees a factory as a kind of servant or slave."
For he reckoned the Maori had slaves.
"Oh, what bosh! You do not understand the situation, Mr. Jeannot Sell. He is in complete accord with me. He understands everything."
Mr. Bone, as was his usual habit, withdrew his repeating watch from his pocket. Before he had completed the motion, the crowd sucked in its breath as one and stepped back, horrified expressions on their faces. They murmured "Atua" at each other. Mr. Bone looked to John Grapple for an explanation.
"Hum,"
Hum, said Grapple, with a twisted expression, putting aside his Scots speech in favor of plain English.
They fancy your watch is a demon. They say they can hear its heart beating.
Mr. Bones smiled to hear such simple suppositions and added to the tension by pressing the button that activated the chiming mechanism. A soft ding-ding came from the watch. A man in the crowd shouted something.
What did he say? Asked Mr. Bone.
He said the demon wishes to escape from his prison, said Grapple. I suggest you put your watch away, sir, as the Maori have strong feelings about such instruments. Some years ago a whaler stopped here to rewater and gather spars. The clumsy captain managed to drop his watch in the harbour, and a number of fatal illnesses and calamities fell on the people in the following weeks. They ascribed those troubles to the evil spirit that was lurking beneath their harbour.
But Mr. Bone decided to display his white man power. Frowning, he shook his watch and then spoke to it harshly as though to a disobedient child before putting it back in his pocket, where once again it seemed to call impetuously to its master to be released. The crowd breathed and drew back a little further. When Mr. Bone asked Grapple sotto voce where the chief had learned his English, Grapple said it was likely he had served as a sailor on an American whaler or sealer, and was of a secretive nature that led him to hide his knowledge in order to gain advantages. Mr. Bones smiled at the chief. He took note of the tattoo pattern that he might recognize him again.
So, sir, he said, do you mostly fish or make war?
Sometime fish, sometime war.
Ha! And what do you suppose I do with my life?
You travel about?
Mr. Bones spoke slowly and loudly, as one did with foreigners, and also because the birds in the branches above them overwhelmed their voices.
No, I rarely travel about. I live in America, and, as I said, I make the best axes, like that one.
He pointed to the Penobscot axe the chief still held in his hand. Mr. Bone extended his hand and waggled the fingers with a beckoning motion to show he wanted the axe returned to him. The Maori looked at Mr. Bone, his eye darkened, and he fled with the axe.
Here, cried Mr. Bone, you ruffian, bring that back at once.
But the man had disappeared into the ferns.
You are impetuous, Mr. Bone, said John Grapple. Metal tools are highly prized here.
He smiled, and his voice wheedled. The Scots accent thickened.
He believes you get to him as a gift. Why do you not come to my house, and we'll have a wee dram and a gab, eh? Let us move away frae these bickering blatherskites.
Indeed, the birds were fiery in their declamations. Gineau and Mr. Bone ate and slept in a hut in one of the established missionaries' enclaves. Gourd plants grew up the sides, extending their tendrils to the roof peak, and jeweled geckos hunting insects rustled through them.
When Mr. Rainborough's mission buildings are in place, we will shift houses, or when I find a factory site and put up our first dwellings. But for the time being, we must accept this small guest house under the trees as our temporary home, said Mr. Bone.
Do I hear my name mentioned?
Called the missionary's voice as he came into the twilight hut smiling and humming a hymn.
I am well pleased with the site for our mission. It lies on a moderate bluff overlooking the harbour and has a brisk stream of excellent water running through it. We have already begun the construction. Before I left, 50 or more Maoris were cutting great poles and lashing them together with vines, a curious but effective way of construction.
At the end of the second week, the missionary had become a partner with the trader Orion Palmer, a Maine man who had come to New Zealand years before in a sealer and had no intention of returning to the pine tree lands, where trees burst with cold in the winter nights. Gineau rose before dawn to the sound of intertwining bird calls, haunting, organ-like notes, slow and deliberate, as if the bird was deeply considering the composition. Low notes and harmonics seemed to express both sadness and resignation. A distant bird answered from far in the forest, and the somber voices laced together. He twisted his head this way and that, trying to find the feathered creature that made such a poignant song. And he saw it,
A large blue-gray bird opening and closing its wings, fanning its tail. It showed a black mask, and under its chin hung two blue wattles. The bird arched its neck, opened its strong, curved beak, and called lingeringly, "Ing, ong, ang, ang, cleat, ing." Outside, Jeannot climbed up to the ridge through a forest so unlike the pine forests of Maine, New Brunswick, and Ontario, or any other he had ever seen, he never could have imagined it. He sensed antiquity in the place, but could not know that he was walking through the oldest living forest on Earth, part of a world never scoured by encroaching glaciers, never overrun with grazing mammals. With the industrial ugliness of London fresh in his mind, New Zealand's beauty moved him powerfully. It was a fresh world pulsing with life and color, the trees dripping vines, epiphytes, scarlet flowers, and dizzying perfumes spilling from cascades of tiny orchids, supplejack knitting the forest together, red-fluffed rata, a place hidden from the coarser world by its remoteness. He had the feeling he should not be here. Perhaps it was one of the tapu places the missionaries had joked about. The ground was cut with wooded ravines. At the bottom of each ran a clear stream. Threads of water twisted through tree roots. Birds crowded the tree branches like fruits, and the crowns twitched with their movements. He would come to know many of them and the trees. Totora, Beech, Kahikatea, Rimu, Matai and Miro, Manuka and Kanuka, the great Kauri and Nikau palms. When he came on a secluded stand of kauri, their great gray trunks like monster elephant legs, he touched bark, looked up into the bunched limbs at the tops of the sheer and monstrous stems. He imagined he felt the tree flinch and drew back his hand. In his desire to see every part of this new forest, he left the trail and descended into a ravine. It was like a somewhat nightmarish dream when he ignorantly touched a glistening leaf and received a burning jolt of pain. Looking closely at the leaves of this small tree, the stinging nettle tree, he could see silvery hairs. Alas, not a true paradise. And there were mosquitoes. A wave of anxiety suddenly washed over him, and he felt he had to get out of the ravine quickly. His feet tangled in creepers and rough vines in the maze of supplejack. An extraordinary jumble of plants, grasses, vines, trees, shrubs were crowded together in huge knots. His clothes, decayed by long exposure to sun and salt, began to tear as he climbed up again, slipping on the muddy slope, hoping to find the trail again, his pants in ribbons from cutty grass. Above him, at the head of the ravine, lay an old kumara field which in recent years had reverted to bracken. 8 or 10 women and girls, their ko-sticks laid aside, were resting from their labor of digging aruhe, fern root. The roots, many of them 10 and 12 inches long, fat and heavy, were piled in great heaps. "What is that sound?" asked a small girl, cocking her head, alert to everything out of the ordinary. They all listened. Yes, breaking branches and scrabbling slide of soil, a kind of thrashing in the ravine below. They half rose in trepidation, ready to flee. The noise came closer, and then a frightful creature came up over the rim and ran straight at them. Jeannot, stained with mud, panting and itchy, clawed up out of the ravine. His bloodied clothing hung in shreds. His hair was spiky with sweat. To his delight, he saw the women surrounded by their piles of fern roots. He could not resist. All his life, girls had welcomed his company. But this time, as he ran toward them, smiling and stretching out his arms, waiting to be welcomed, they fled as if from an indescribable terror, some crying in fear. He shouted at them, "Come back! I mean no harm!" They were already out of sight. And the old, smiling, merry Jeannot evaporated. In his place, an aging man who had known sorrow and difficulty, and now painful rejection. Mr. Bone had spread a mat on the ground and was sitting cross-legged on it, drinking tea and eating baked yam and fruits. Jeannot returned his greeting with a peevish grunt.
How I wish we had possessed the foresight to bring sacks of coffee. Tea is all very well, but it is not coffee.
Jeannot said nothing, but he knew Mr. Bones' Scots cousin, John Grapple, had a store of coffee. He had smelled it on the path out of the forest that ran behind the Pakeha houses. Several days later, while Jeannot was mending his torn clothing with a borrowed needle and Mr. Bones scratching in his idea book, the chief with the many-colored flax cape reappeared.
"Oh, Mr. Captain, sir," he said in a wheedling tone, "you have many acts?"
"I have 50 in a crate," said Mr. Bone, putting down his pen and waving at the hut where the crate stood. "For demonstration only. As I explained, it is my hope to establish an axe factory here. It is my hope to teach the Maori how to make axes of quality. I feel there is a great need here."
"You want to see good deck for feckery? You walk me."
He gestured to an oblique trail leading into the bush.
"Is it a place with a stream of running water?"
"Oh, yes. Too many water."
Mr. Bones smiled, turned to Jeannot, and said,
"You see, it was very easy to interest this man in my idea. I'll warrant he knows of a good location for the factory."
"Mr. Bone, it is not possible. The trader says there is no iron ore in the entire country and laughs at you. You cannot make axes without metal."
"I think I know better than you, Mr. Jeannot Sell, what I can and cannot do. It is not that there is no ore. It is only that it has not yet been found."
The cloaked Maori stood outside the hut, stepping backward along the trail and beckoning to Mr. Bone.
"I would not go with him," said Jeannot in a low voice. "He may be planning mischief."
"Bosh! I'll be perfectly safe. He is friendly. For a savage, Mr. Jeannot Sell, you are timid. Nor do you understand these people any more than you understand establishing yourself in a new place."
He went on, for he had heard how the women had fled from the awful stranger lurching out of the ravine. It was the talk of the missionary enclave.
"This is why white men get ahead. They know how to command. He will be my first recruit. In a year, he will be running the trip hammer. I take no satisfaction in saying that after all these years you prove a sad disappointment to me."
Mr. Bone left the hut and followed his eager guide up the trail. After a mile and a little more, the trail became faint and disappeared, but the chief pushed on, following a way marked with ponga ferns turned silver side up, invisible to Mr. Bone. Two more Maori fell silently in behind the axe entrepreneur, who was so absorbed in looking at the massive tree trunks that he did not notice.
Huge, huge trees, giants of the earth, the pale gray columns as wide as European houses. Who could believe such immensity? Was it possible an axe could take such monstrous trees down? Could they be?
Much moved, he called to the chief.
"Tell me, are these kauri trees?"
"Kauri,"
said the man, turning around and flashing his eyes at someone behind Mr. Bone. But so stunned was Mr. Bone by the impossible trees that he was not aware of the descending club that burst his brain. His last shattered thought was that a great kauri had fallen on him.
"Quick,"
said the chief to one of his comrades, pulling out a fresh-edged obsidian knife.
"Do you run back and get the axes? Then return here and help me carry the meat."
Before he severed the limbs, he gingerly withdrew the queer watch from Mr. Bone's pocket. The demon's heart was pounding, pounding.
"We know how to deal with you,"
said the chief, placing the evil thing on a large leaf and covering it with another protective magic leaf while he got on with the cutting up. He spoke true words. For that night he cast the watch into the fire, and with satisfaction all the sated assembly saw the demon fling his wiry arms out as he cried aloud, then perished. 2 days later, when Mr. Bone had not returned, Jeannot felt mildly uneasy, but the headstrong old man had had his way as always, and would likely make some kind of a success of his venture. No doubt he was looking for iron ore. Jeannot, his captive, now wanted to find a ship going to Boston and work his way home, although the mariner's trade was unfamiliar to him.
He would quit Mr. Bone, for he knew a South Sea axe factory was an improbable dream. There was no metal ore in New Zealand, from all he had heard. Miners and explorers aplenty, but no mines. Even if there were grand mines, he was finished with axe-making. He wanted only to go back to whatever was left of the places he knew. The wild New Zealand forest had moved him in incomprehensible ways, yet it repulsed him with its violent tangle of vegetable exuberance, its unfamiliarity and ancient aloofness. To escape, he would have to get to Port Jackson first, unless an American whaler put into Hokianga Port. Mr. Bone could not hold him. He would leave with or without the old man. He was planning his escape when Mr. Rainborough marched into the hut, breathing heavily, his eyes slitted.
"Where is Mr. Bone?"
His voice was penetratingly loud, and Jeannot saw people standing outside the hut, listening and watching.
"I do not know. He set off several days ago with a native man wearing a grass cloak. Against my advice."
"Your advice? Who are you, a servant, to give advice to Mr. Bone? Which native man did he go with?"
"I do not know, sir. Only that it was a native man, much tattooed and wearing a cloak."
"I beg to inform you, sir."
There was a sneer in his voice.
"That there is much apprehension as to his whereabouts. It is thought he has come to harm, and the one under suspicion is not some mysterious native in a grass cloak, but you, his servant, who have prowled the ravines of the locale with an eye to disposing of your master's body."
"Untrue," said Jeannot. "You have only to ask Mr. Grapple. He knows the native man, and first introduced Mr. Bone to him."
"What a pity. John Grapple is in Port Jackson for a month on business. You must be confined to this hut until he returns. I will arrange for food to be brought to you, but you, Sel, are our prisoner, pending verification of your statements. We shall mount guards against any attempted escape."
Back in his mission, Mr. Rainborough put fresh ink in the inkwell, selected a steel nib, and composed a letter.
"Reverend Rainborough to Mr. Joseph Dogg, Bone Axe Company, Massachusetts. Sir, I am prompted to get in touch with you re circumstances relating to your employer, Mr. Albert Bone, whom I had the pleasure of travelling with these past 8 months. We esteemed each other greatly. Indeed, I may say we became close friends. Within the last few days, a worrisome circumstance has arisen which I feel I must impart to you. Mr. Bone was accompanied by his servant, Jeannot Sell, a dark-skinned man, much given to exploration of the forest, and who has frightened some of the natives by suddenly appearing from behind a bush and screeching at them. It is with concern that I write that his forays into the forest may have a sinister motive. Mr. Bone disappeared entirely from our enclave 3 days ago and has not been seen since. Within this hour I have quizzed Mr. Sell on his knowledge of Mr. Bone's whereabouts. He insists that his employer went away with a native wearing a grass cloak. As many do wear grass cloaks, there is no way to discern the truth of this statement except, as Sell claims, by a witness, that is the respected interpreter in these parts, Mr. John Grapple, who is unfortunately away on business for some weeks and therefore cannot vouch for Sell's statements. I have taken the liberty of confining Sell to his quarters until Mr. Grapple returns and we can get at the truth of this matter. I have also taken Mr. Bone's money-box into care, as I suspect it is the motive for Mr. Bone's disappearance and for Sell's forays into the trees. His claim that Mr. Bone owed him money lends weight to my suspicions. Should Mr. Bone have come to harm, I can assure you that I can act for him as his friend and spiritual adviser in every way. I have considerable influence in the country, and can arrange to have his possessions returned to Boston, and see to it that the servant Sell receives British justice, for New Zealand has recently been annexed by the mother country. I can oversee any legal matters that may arise. To my knowledge, he has made no will in the colony, but perhaps you know more than I of such a document, if it exists at all. I will inform you at once if we learn anything in the matter. I am, etc., the Reverend Edward Torrance Rainborough, Church Missionary, New Zealand."
Confined to the hut, Gino's days passed slowly. One of the missionary wives brought him roasted yams and fish. She never spoke to him, and if he asked a question, she scuttled away. He thought about this often, that here in New Zealand every woman he had seen ran from him, shunned him. The four powerful Maori guards lounged around outside, waiting for his escape, two of them scratching at pieces of dark green stone, the other two talking and laughing with each other. He stood in the doorway on some days, sat on the veranda on others, listening for the kokako, but always watching the harbor. From the doorway he could see a rock outcrop in the near distance crowned with half a dozen old pohutukawa trees, setting the world on fire with their crimson blossoms. He would rather have seen a ship. If an American ship put in, he would risk everything to get to it. But only English ships arrived to take on Kauri spars. Every day he looked out past the pohutukawa trees to scan the sea for vessels. One morning he saw that the oldest tree at the end was down. As he stared, he caught the flash of an axe and made out two white men attacking the trees. As the trees fell, each sent up a puff of red blossoms like an exclamation. By late afternoon, they were all down, and he looked no more in that direction. It was more than a month before Grapple climbed up the hill to his house again, followed almost immediately by several of the missionaries. The reverend men started back down the greasy, steep slope a quarter of an hour later, but it was not until dusk that Mr. Rainborough and his crony Boxall came to the guest house, both looking sour.
"It is my duty to say that John Grapple has returned from Port Jackson. He does corroborate your tale of the native in the grass cloak, but he says he did not know the man. He is a chief from other parts who somehow heard of Mr. Bone and wanted to know him. He may have been one of the rare bad Maori. There is no way to tell, as his name and place are unknown here."
Boxall said in a rush, "So there is no reason to hold you. You may leave."
"That is very well," said Gino Sell. "I would like to return to my country. I ask you to pay me my wages from Mr. Bone's money box. He has not paid me since we left Boston more than a year ago."
Mr. Rainborough wriggled his shoulders as if his coat was out of order. He cast his eyes around the hut as if looking for the money box.
"Sir, you must know we cannot do such a thing. The money in Mr. Bone's strongbox belongs to him, and if he does not return, it will go to his heirs and family. I doubt you are among that number. In any case, I shall take it for safekeeping, lest you be tempted to help yourself."
"But I have no money for my passage."
"I suggest that you take up the axe again. Mr. Bone said you were once a good woodsman. You can earn your way back to where you came from. And to show there are no hard feelings, I will tell you that after discussion with Mr. Palmer, I understand there is suitable work for you felling trees. Mr. Palmer owns several shore stations with allied timber camps in the Kauri bush. You shall leave tomorrow."
Yes, it seemed he must do that and save his wages until he could buy passage. He was old now, but his scarred leg had improved over the years, and he felt he could swing an axe. What else could he do? And he would be away from the swarm of missionaries and their ukases.
53. In the Bush.
At the Bunder shore station, Gino was disturbed to see some Maori selling tattooed enemy heads to eager white man sailors as curiosities. He thought suddenly of Kuntaw and imagined him laughing at the gruesome sight. Kuntaw always laughed at horrors as though they were nothing much. Gino walked away for fear he might see Mr. Bone's old gray head among the wares. He went into the trader's Whare Hoka to see the show of goods, brilliant bolts of cotton, wooden flutes, tambourines, buttons, and spools of thread in 12 magical colors. This was the place to find precious needles, choose from an array of hats, and yes, axes of poor quality. A Maori would come in timidly for the first time and stand in the center of the Whare Hoka, then turn slowly, slowly, to see everything, dazzled and made to desire many strange objects of unknown use.
Imprisoned in the hut, Jeannot had overheard the missionaries say that Sydney merchants were filling all the good harbors of the Northland with shore stations, in the Hokianga, on the Coromandel, anywhere there was deep water and handy timber.
Opening the country right up, they said with approval.
Miles apart, the stations were not only logging camps, but trading posts dealing in flax, spars, and lumber. Separate enterprises, chandlers, warehouses, sawmills, and small shipyards, drew Europeans to them. They skimmed off the cream of the shore forest and moved the camps on to the next good show, leaving behind smoldering stumps and shoulder-deep waste. The intense assault fell first on the Kahikatea, then on the Kauri, cutting and cutting. In some places, men could walk for days on the downed timber that carpeted the ground. Then the great mass was set alight, the fastest way to clear the forest, brush, vines, birds, insects, fruit, bats, epiphytes, twigs, ferns, and forest litter. The newcomers did not care to understand the strange new country beyond taking whatever turned a profit. They knew only what they knew. The forest was there for them. Trader Palmer had two logging camps, Little Yam and Big Yam, named for nearby Maori plantations of sweet potatoes. Many of his warehouses and camps stood on land that had once belonged to members of his wife's clan. Smart and wily, a fluent and persuasive talker, he moved people to his advantage as a cook moves gobbets of meat around in the hot pan. Temporary or not, Jeannot had never seen a camp so flimsy and ragtail bob as the Little Yam. The quarters that passed for a bunkhouse were nothing more than ridgepole tents with fly openings, thatched with great hairy masses of nikau leaves from the cabbage palm. Almost every small mixed-race child that Jeannot saw in New Zealand looked like Waddy Baker, the bush boss, swart, pale-eyed, and quick-handed, whether catching something or striking someone with his waddy. The bush gang at the Little Yam was small, not more than 20 choppers, ex-sailors, ex-convicts, Irish, British settlers, Maori. Half of them had never worked in the woods before. The evening meal was a Captain Cooker stew from descendants of the pigs Cook had released, and a loaf of bread for each man. Jeannot hoped to find a partner who knew woods work. If luck was with him, a partner who knew the ways of big Kauri cutting, for he reckoned there was something to learn about taking down these giants beyond the swinging of an axe. The young rickers they would cut first would be easy, but when he thought about it, he did not see how they could do more than nibble around the circumference of the gray-bark giants. They were just too massive. He had heard that the Maori got them down by cutting into them and then making and tending a fire in the cut until the tree burned through. It was a poor method, as the burning hardened the wood so that no sawmill could get through such a log. As for getting the logs to the sawmills on the shore, he hoped there was a better way than what he had seen while standing in the doorway of the missionary hut in detention. One morning, smoking his pipe and regarding an offshore pod of spouting whales, he heard a distant rhythmic chant, a call-and-response chant such as a ship crew's capstan shanty stamp-and-go used when weighing anchor. At least 80 Maori men emerged from the forest, hauling on a hawser bound around an immense Kauri spar. A muscular headman stood on the log, which was decorated with flowers and feathers, and it was he who called out the urging chant, and the pullers, who drew deep breaths, opened their mouths and roared a response as they heaved. The great spar moved forward a few feet on the roller roadway. Again and again, the pullers answered the caller, and the giant mast moved down to the ship. Jeannot worked one day with a half-Maori named Arana Palmer, who spoke English with what sounded like his own familiar Maine accent. He was young, not more than 20, and strong, said, "I worked in the Kauri since I was a boy." When Jeannot told him he was a Penobscot man from Maine, Arana laughed. "Orion Palmer, the trader, is my father. He come here from Maine years ago after seals. Them times not many Pakeha, so I say I am part Maine. He talks once in a while about his old life there. You come talk with him sometime.
He likes talking Maine. Goes down to the ship, says, "Anybody from Maine here?" Sometimes there is, and he'll keep him up all night guzzling rum and talk, talk, talk. Get Jeezalem drunk.
Jeannot had not heard anyone say Jeezalem in years and was glad to hear it now, in Arana's inherited accent. Arana showed Jeannot how to stuff a large sack with bracken fern for a mattress. Better, said his new partner, was to get a wool fleece. Nothing more comfortable. They agreed to work together and share one of the thatched tents. Before he fell asleep, Jeannot looked forward to replacing the ferns with a fleece. He was no longer the man he had been the last time he chopped trees. His scarred leg would carry him in the mornings. By the end of the workday, it burned and ached intolerably and could barely take his weight. He was too old for logging.
"What troubles your leg?" asked Arana,
and Jeannot told him of the Miramichi fire that had nearly caught him, that had burned his brother Amboise. It was a great ease to have conversation with someone he liked. It had been a long, long time since he had had the pleasure of friendship. He went with Arana to meet his father, Orion Palmer, the trader from Maine. The white-haired old ruffian launched into a flood of reminiscence about his early days in Maine and a long, involved story of why he could never go back, something to do with killing a rich man's horse. The labor of axing down a tree with the girth of a village church was monstrous. The bushman tried every way, whittling around the sides for weeks until the trunk began to resemble a pencil, chipping and chopping until a saw could finish the cut. Or chopping out a commodious room within the living tree, room enough to swing an axe, a great waste of good timber. They built platforms to lift them above the stack of debris at the base of every kauri. It took weeks to bring down a single giant. The axe alone was not enough, and the trader ordered 10-foot felling saws, double-tooth rakers every 4 teeth, onto the job. When the saws arrived, the kauri began to come down by the hundreds.
"Now we're doing it,"
said Shuttercock, one of the choppers. On the shore near the wharves, Palmer's roaring steam-powered sawmill, specially equipped to handle kauri, spat out the most desirable lumber in the world day after day. Hundreds of Maori hauled vast logs to these mills, inching them up out of the ravines, easing them down the steep slope below the ridge. They could not bring them in fast enough to suit Palmer, who began to talk of getting bullocks from Australia.
"Queensland," he said, "where there's good timber broke beasts to be had."
On Saturday nights, Arana went home to his father's house to exchange his filthy work clothes for fresh, sink into his mother's large family clan again, and eat his favorite dishes, to be Maori once more. Jeannot stayed in the camp, washed and mended his single garment, a pair of canvas trousers torn off at the knee. Arana came back one Sunday evening with a home delicacy, a basket of eels that had been wrapped in leaves of green flax and roasted over coals.
"We worked all day fixing our eel weirs. Some settlers pulled up all the manuka steaks that show the eel the way into the hinaki."
Between mouthfuls of the juicy meat, they talked about weirs and nets and eel pots, the different ways to make good weirs.
"Mi'kmaq make weirs with river stones," said Jeannot,
arranging pebbles on the ground.
"Takes a lot of attention. The river shifts them."
Arana explained how brush and ferns could be worked in between the manuka stakes to make a good fence, and spoke eloquently on the importance of a strong and beautiful hinaki net that did the eels honor. For Jeannot, cutting his first big kauri was pain. He had to clear away a mountain of debris around the tree with axe and brush hook, with hoe and mattock. Then it had taken 3 days to chop out a large enough room so he could climb up and get inside the tree, and in a twisted half-crouch swing his axe. At last the true assault began. He managed the first hour, but the pain in his leg was bad, very bad. At noon he moved like a crab to the edge of his chopping hole to get down to the ground and some cold tea. He was not hungry. He jumped and felt something give way in his knee. When he tried to stand upright, the bad leg folded. He could not straighten it and fell again.
the knee hitting the mattock point. Arana saw him down, loped over, and looked at blood seeping through Gino's pants.
"We'll get it fixed," he said. "We'll get you right."
He cut a forked sapling and made a makeshift crutch, helped the injured man up. Gino, standing because he could not sit, drank a quart of tepid tea, leaned against the maimed Kaori, and panted. He put his head against the old tree's gray bark and whispered,
"You got me this time."
"You can't work,"
said Arana, and helped him back to the bunkhouse, pulled off his trousers, and looked at the knee still oozing blood from the blue and swelling cut. The knee looked strangely flat. He got water from the cook and tore a bit of rag from his extra shirt, mopped the wound, and left Gino to lie there all afternoon, trying to find a position that would ease the pain. There was no doctor. Palmer did any necessary doctoring or burying. Arana brought him in the next day, and the trader looked at Gino's knee, deformed when the ligament had torn and the patella moved up into the thigh. The mattock wound was red and swollen.
"Christ," he said. "You better lay up. Main man heals pretty quick, so we'll see."
He noticed Gino's graying hair. The man had aged in New Zealand. He went up to the store himself and got two bottles of opium-heavy patent medicines, Sydenham's laudanum and Dover's powder.
"'Cause he's not no chicken now. Older fella. You don't heal so good."
While he was gone, Arana put his hand on Gino's burning cheek, leaned over and said into his ear,
"Rest. Rest."
Gino slid in and out of narcotic dreams in the bunkhouse for a week while the infected wound broke free from restraint, galloping headlong toward victory. Bright with fever, panting, he did not recognize Arana. Called out to Francois. Arana and Palmer regarded the leg, one vast black blister. Arana sighed. Arana and Shuttercock buried Gino near the river at the edge of the hayfield where they had cut rickers 2 years earlier. Before the last shovelful of earth topped the grave, it began to rain. They walked back up the steep, tree-bare slope, sloughing off muddy soil as the rain increased. It was the beginning of a great lopping storm that loosed unreasonable torrents. The mountain streams, joined by other runaway water, raced flashing down the hills, carrying rocks, ricker slash, logs, gravel, soil, the old cookhouse, and, disinterring Gino's cell, swept his carcass out into the Pacific. The old year ended trembling in storms of wind after a wild winter, but once again a fresh spring morning, pastel and calm, gave Mr. Rainborough pleasure as he sucked in the sweet air. He left the door open and hoped for no interruptions. If he finished all his correspondence within the hour, he would have the afternoon free to count and arrange the flax bales in his storeroom. But before he had written half a page, he heard tramping on the earthen path and a figure loomed, entered his sunny workroom. Another followed. He thought that he had rarely seen uglier customers than the two men who stood with folded arms staring at him. One was hoop-backed and swart, an aging hunchback with obsidian eyes in a flat American Indian face. The other had even more marked Indian features and a wiry body. His inward-drawn mouth showed that he cared for neither Englishmen nor missionaries. To Mr. Rainborough, the pressed-in lips and knotted eyebrows indicated a particularly disagreeable nature.
"Yes,"
said the missionary in the brusque voice he used to dust off time wasters.
"Joe Dog,"
said the crooked man, fishing in his pocket, then extending Mr. Rainborough's own letter written several years earlier. It was stained and tattered, one corner quite torn away.
"I am Mr. Bone's foreman and acting manager of the Axe Works. Your letter came to me. Has Mr. Bone now returned? My inquiries have remained unanswered."
"Oh, he has never returned. We are quite satisfied that he was decoyed and killed by a renegade Maori. It is quite sure that poor Mr. Bone is dead. Quite sure."
"What basis have you for that surety?"
Well, blustered Mr. Rainborough, well, because it is known by some, I am not at liberty to say whom, that he was killed. Killed and likely,
his voice dropped,
in the custom of some of these heathens, eaten.
Dog grimaced, shook his head as if driving off an irritating sweat bee.
We will have proof of your assertion, sir. People do not just disappear. People are not just eaten.
In New Zealand, it can happen. Mr. Bone was headstrong and showed no reticence in going into the forest with a native he did not know. Guile is part of the Maori nature.
I ask you to produce those people who know, said Joseph Dog. A great deal depends on being sure. And what of his money box? Do you have it?
I keep it in a safe place. It is in my cupboard in my sleeping room. I will get it directly.
The words tripped over each other like a too often repeated prayer. The hard-faced Indian, clenching and unclenching his fists, spoke loudly and angrily.
Where is Gino's cell? I wish to see Gino.
Mr. Rainborough also had a wish, that he might be instantly transported to a desert isle. If he had never written that letter, these men would have remained forever in their wretched land of rebels and upstarts.
He too is dead.
Dog, the hunchback, who had been looking out at the harbor, spun around, spoke in a tigerish voice.
What? Gino dead? Not possible. Never. How? When?
Last year in I have forgotten the month.
He died how? Or did he also disappear?
He died of illness, of blood poison. He worked as a bushman and hurt his foot, or leg. His friend, Arana Palmer, was with him, and no doubt can tell you all the particulars.
Joseph Dog said in a low voice, Perhaps you do not know that Gino Sell was not Mr. Bone's servant, as you surmise, but was greatly favored by him as a friend and business associate, and it is to him that Mr. Bone has willed all his works and possessions, which include the axe factory in Massachusetts. And if truly he is dead, and if Gino is also dead, then likely Mr. Bone's holdings will shift into Gino's estate and go to his son Aaron. I have the responsibility to bring all details back to Aaron Sell, who could not make the interminable journey.
I am also Sell, said the dark Indian. Etienne Sell, an uncle of Gino Sell, although he was older than me by many years. We came to reclaim him and take him back to his home country. If what you say is true, we must have his bones that he may be returned to the land where he began. This is important.
I cannot speak to the whereabouts of his grave, said Mr. Rainborough, seeking an escape route. I can only advise you to search out Arana Palmer, one of the sons of the trader here, Mr. Orion Palmer. He was a friend of Gino Sell, and I think did bury him, where I do not know. So, I wish you good day, gentlemen, and good fortune with discovering what you wish to know.
The money box, sir, said Joseph Dog. I will take it in hand before we leave this place. I trust you have not availed yourself of any of the funds.
A cloud passed over the sun, briefly dimming the flood of light through the open door.
How dare you, sir, imply that I am a thief?
Mr. Rainborough swelled up. The word sir hissed through his teeth.
Why, Mr. Rainbillow, I see that you are a clergyman of sorts, and it has been my experience that pastors, ministers, clergymen, and church officials of all kinds feel entitled to use any stray funds that come their way to further their influence and control of local affairs, as well as building new churches, adding wings to existing churches, gilding the altar, and such so-called good works, especially improving the parsonage or the wine cellar.
I will have you know that I have not touched a halfpence,
lied the missionary, who had, in fact, used more than 100 pounds of Mr. Bone's money to build the storeroom where he cashed his bales of flax.
It will be a simple matter to judge, said Joe Dog, as I know to the last penny what Mr. Bone had in that box. I have his monthly accounts up until 3 years ago,
when correspondence ceased. He was meticulous in noting his expenditures. Before we depart, I will conduct my examination of the contents of the money box and any papers he may have left. Also, you will present that proof of his demise.
They left the missionary biting at his thumbnail. Sunlight washed the room as before.
Orion Palmer leaned on his counter near the open door, his narrow temples surmounted by a wave of cresting auburn hair, his hard blue eyes wide open. Etienne stared at his odd face, for below the earlobes, the jaws swelled out, fleshy and full, carried down to a thick neck.
My son? Which one? I have more than a dozen, all fine fellows, but I certainly do not know the whereabouts of each, most with their mother's people.
The trader, in an easy mood and pleased with the fine day and the flock of sheep-like clouds marching overhead, sized up the two men.
Your son, Arana Palmer, sir, said Etienne in the weighty voice he used with assertive white men. We have heard that he knew my nephew, Gino Sell.
Eh, yeah, he did.
The trader sighed and thought for a long moment.
Pret sure Arana is working the cowrie yet.
He picked his teeth with a long fingernail.
Yep, he did know Gino. We all known him. He frighted the women wicked when he first come here. So some took a dislike to him. He died of a poisoned wound. Nothing we could do. Too late for amputation and no white man doctor here, just me, and I don't go in for cutting men's limbs off.
As he warmed up, he became more voluble, his limber mouth stretched in the smirk of a self-regarding man.
I say he was not young or strong enough in the first place to work cutting kauri, but the missionary put him to it so's he could earn his passage back home. He tried. Chopping kauri calls for strong young men, he said. He was not so young. Prit lame, though he knew well how to handle the axe. You could see that. He said he was a Penobscot man, and maybe he was a long time ago. Them days is gone, you see. We got circle saws and trained bullocks. Now bullocks!
He was ready to tell them his brilliant innovation of importing bullocks to New Zealand, for the trader had to get some indication of his importance into every conversation. But something in their intent, leaning postures, their serious eyes following his lips as he spoke, deterred him. He told them instead to take the steamer 2 harbors north, and, following the map he sketched out on a broken packing case slat, to walk the track to the Big Yam camp, where the choppers and sawyers were laying the kauri down. He wished them luck.
And I guess you want to finish your business here pretty quick, as the Vigor is leaving for Port Jackson next week. We don't get that many ships these days since the whales is all gone. Catch the Vigor and return to your own place.
Etienne spoke. We only just come here. Long, long trip. We see something of this new land. Not leave so soon. Country pretty different to Iktaggamkuk. He stared out at the bulging forest line beyond the cutover slope, hardly believing the size of the stumps.
Arana can show you. His mother is Maori. The Maori got a good many tapu places you best not disturb.
And the trader drew the edge of his hand across his throat. The calm morning had changed. Intermittent clouds now cast their stuttering shadows over the landscape. Arana, when they found him at work, was, like many Maori, handsome and strongly built, with great leg muscles. There was little of the trader Orion Palmer in his appearance beyond a slightly oversized jaw. His hair hung long and snaggled. He listened to them, then said, "Come with me," and led them through the stumps to an awkward place, a huge kauri stump surrounded by slash and the great pale arms of its severed limbs. He jumped on the flat top, the size of a barn door, and beckoned them to join him.
"This is the very stump of the kauri Gino was cutting when his bad leg gave way. There's the cuts he made," he said, and pointed to the axe marks on the outer rings.
Etienne touched the graying wood. Old axe marks, all that remained here to show that Gino had walked the earth. He diverted the conversation to the peculiarities of these curious tree giants that tempted woodsmen with their perfectly knotless bodies, for he too had chopped trees in Maine and Nova Scotia,
and had never seen anything like them. Arana said they were a kind of pine.
"Many men say," said Arana, "that kauri is the best wood in the world."
They smoked their pipes in silence for some time. Etienne said, "What can you tell us of Jinot here?"
"He wanted to return to you but could not. He had no money.
What else could he do? Become a trader?
My father would not allow that.
A cook?
Perhaps.
But he knew the axe. He knew how to bring a tree down even if it were the biggest tree of the world. He was very skilled with axes. He made a chair one Sunday, all with his axe. I think he was lonely here. Nobody to talk with but me and some of the choppers. He said he never meant to come here, but that man, Mr. Bone, made him do it. He did not want to cut kauri. He said they were trees of power, and we also believe this. I do not think he ever told me of his uncle."
He squinted at Etienne as if he had just jumped down from the sky.
"He could not, for he did not know me, huh? His grandfather, my father, Kuntaw, left Penobscot a long time ago and returned to his Mi'kmaq people near Sebaganagadik River. Kuntaw got two wives after that white man woman, and one of them, my mother. Settlers pressed on us, the Scotlands, destroyed our eel weirs, burned our wigwams."
Arana nodded at the mention of eels. They were his bond with Jinot.
"The government give our reserve to those Scotland people with burning hair color. So Kuntaw led us across the water to Iktagamkuk, as the white men say, Newfoundland, where there were good eel rivers, good fish, and some Mi'kmaq people. For us it was good, because the whites did not go into the rough parts of this place. But we did, and now we live well. We come to bring Jinot back with us. Aaron was there for 2 years. He went to Boston. We look, we can't find him to come here with us."
Joseph Dog, who had been silent during this recitation, asked softly if white men were not pushing into such a bountiful country.
"Yes," said Etienne, "but it is rich only for us Mi'kmaq. For white men who want something that makes money, it is not promising. They come not to make houses, but only hunt caribou and get fish. These white men come to Kuntaw and ask him to take them to good fishing places. No harm can come from that."
Joe Dog rolled his eyes and said emphatically,
"It is dangerous to bring white men into your country. However rough the trail, they remember it and soon begin to want it."
Etienne said, "We live our Mi'kmaq life. That is what we want to give to Jinot." Looking at Arana, he shifted the talk.
"The trader said you were a good friend to Jinot. Maybe you will tell us about this place that he came to. Maybe you will show us how you and your mother's people live. We like to know this."
Arana was silent for long minutes, then said, "We will go in the bush with my sister Kahu, Hekanohi Komiromiro. She has the eyesight of that little bird that finds invisible insects. She knows the forest with all her senses."
Their excursion fell on a day of days, clear and bright at sunrise in the time of nesting birds. They were five in number, for not only did Arana's elder sister Kahu come with her pet parrot on her shoulder, but also their young cousin Ihe, muscular and as quick of motion as the dolphin in her name. Ihe's crinkly hair seemed alive and moving, as though each strand was a tendril reaching for a hold. Kahu's pet Kaka flashed his red underwings and shouted whenever he felt like it, which was frequently, a call that sounded to Joe Dog like someone ripping boards off the side of a barn. Arana and Kahu tried to explain their country, despairingly because it could not be explained but only lived, saying all land was owned by Maori tribes and clans, who kept forests intact for birds and only cut trees judiciously. Ihe interrupted, saying hotly that some tribal chiefs were greedy and sold their relatives' land to white men of the New Zealand Company. As they walked, Kahu pointed at some gnarled pahutakawa trees and said they were sacred. Springs of purest water bubbled out of the ground. In the distance, they could see the swell of the forest like a great wave. They entered what Kahu called the Forest of Tane, and the air became still and heavy. Above them, the westerly wind stirred the treetops, and always some birds rose crying out. They went silently as Kahu pointed out the tallest trees, making a top roof over the forest, the lesser trees below. Joe Dog was scandalized by the way of the rata, which began life in the high branches of other trees, and as